Welcome to this archived LDN Research Trust conference presentation. We hope you enjoy it.
So this is Dr. Brian Udell speaking to you from actually Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And today is July 19th, 2017. And what we're presenting today is information that is bare bones information maybe about low-dose naltrexone for the great conference that's going to take place on September 21st to September 24th at the Portland, Oregon Sheraton Portland Hotel. My name, as I said, is Dr. Brian Udell. My websites, one of them is theautismdoctor.com, and that's where my blog, I put a weekly blog up to talk about the latest issues in autism from the standpoint of a traditionally trained pediatrician. I've been a pediatrician for 40 years. I was a neonatologist. I took care of very sick babies from 1975 through 2000 who had cocaine and drugs in their system. And then in the late part of the last century, it was mostly children who had AIDS. And I saw those children in the follow-up clinic until they were 3 years old. And I really didn't see anything that looks like autism until about 8 years after I had left that clinic. And so something else has happened in this century. My first case of autism was in 1975. So I knew what autism looked like. And yet with all those high-risk pregnancies, we still did not see a problem. Not like autism. And then the other website that's up there is childdev.org, which is my actual practice, where we've seen 2,000 patients since 2009 with special needs, and about 50% of them or more have autism spectrum disorder. And what we're going to talk about today is my discovery. It wasn't my discovery at all of naltrexone as a very important aid to treating patients who have autism spectrum disorder. In 1980s, work was done that was using high-dose naltrexone, and they were actually having some results. And then in 2006, Dr. Jackie McCandless recorded a report where she concluded that it was an effective, non-toxic, non-addicting, and inexpensive behavioral and immune-modulating intervention. It is definitely already joined our biomedical arsenal to help more and more children recover from autism, as well as helping anyone with autoimmune diseases and cancer. And my specialty is children who have autoimmune diseases and autism. And the first question that might come up at this time is, well, can you really recover from autism? And the answer that I have is that there are many different kinds, as you'll see through this talk, of autism, and you absolutely can recover from the signs and symptoms that people call autism. And so if a doctor or a specialist saw that patient today, they would not think the child has any special developmental challenge. When I first saw my patients in 2008 in the clinics here in Fort Lauderdale, I think this is, I want to make sure that we're on background. So I'll make sure that we're on background here. It's the same slide. I'm not sure how these slides are showing up. So this slide is low-dose naltrexone and autism spectrum disorder, and I'm describing Dr. McCandless' conclusion. The background is that when I saw my first cases, it was something like 1 in 110 children back in 2008, and now it's 1 in 68 children, and it affects about 2% of the boys in the U.S. To the strict word of epidemic is any disorder, any disease that happens more than the expected amount, so that it's an epidemic. You don't have to have a specific number. It just has to be, according to Webster, more than an expected number of cases. And certainly, when I saw my first case in 1975, it was 1 in 5 to 10,000, and now we're down to 2% of boys. The treatment has been traditional therapies, which are physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech and language therapy, and other behavioral therapies of different types, and that has really been the mainstay. And there's no treatment that I am aware of at this time that wouldn't include those traditional therapies, whether it's way out treatments that are very expensive and possibly risky, or traditional treatments with any kind of medication. You've got to combine, including my alternative therapies, as I call them, biomedical therapies, you've got to combine them with the traditional therapies for real recovery to take place. The LDN protocols that we will cover are the old ones from the 1980s, which were higher dose and did have actually some results. The recent results, I actually have altered a little bit my use of naltrexone, and my recent results reflect that and conclusions that we can make. And the slide that you should be looking at would be a slide that has a number of different signs and symptoms that we call autism spectrum disorder. My goal, I do not think that I think outside the box. I think that what I'm doing is that I'm connecting the dots. And the dots for me start with repetitive movements, communication problems, and social isolation, which are traditionally called autism. And whether it's DSM-4 or DSM-5, the combination of social problems and movement difficulties or repetitive movements is enough to call a patient under the spectrum umbrella. It does include a lot of patients, and it includes patients that used to be called Asperger syndrome and used to be called PDD-NOS, which is pervasive developmental delay, not otherwise specified. The reason, at least in the U.S., the DSM has been changed is because they felt that powers that be felt that services could be provided to everyone regardless of the specificity of the diagnosis. And indeed, that has helped services get placed in necessary children. But it does slightly increase the number of cases that one might call autism, but a very small percentage. And in this question about whether these patients are really real or we just didn't recognize it before, I can promise you that as a physician who sees lines of patients trying to see our clinic here in South Florida and the other, 50 or so physicians who have been doing this same work for even 10 or 20 years, even longer than I have, that we have definitely seen more and more children who have developmental problems that we did not see in the last century, except for very rarely. So if I'm connecting the dots, the repetitive movements that you see at the top right and the restricted interests that are just below that are often called OCD. Okay, so I have patients that are getting medications, strong medications for obsessive compulsive disorder, and really what they're exhibiting is repetitive movements and restricted interests. And the reason that I feel that's an important distinction is, number one, the medications are rarely helpful. And number two, they carry a lot of side effects and risks. And I've seen children as young as 3 or 4 years old getting very potent medications with severe side effects because the idea was to decrease those disruptive behaviors. And that's very difficult to do. And it really doesn't address the other more important behaviors, which are in the top, the communication, which starts with the speech apraxia, the inability to speak, and social isolation. The kids act like they're in their own world. They definitely look like they're in their own planet. So, frankly, on the scale of things that are the most disturbing when you're trying to get a patient better, repetitive movements and restricted interests are lower than the number one, which is speech, getting speech come in, and then speech get useful. Then you see on the top right, underneath social isolation, is sensory issues. These individuals have just about every system can be involved. Every part of your sense can be involved. Mostly, I find it's usually one or two that are involved in each kid. You won't see a whole lot of children who exhibit problems with all five of those areas. The important thing about this that I'm talking about is vis-a-vis the low dose naltrexone. That I want to as we talk more, the listener will understand. Okay, why I use low dose naltrexone so much and why I find it so helpful is because that whole top area, okay, I've just touched the different symptoms, the different signs and symptoms that my children have, and yet all of those can be addressed successfully sometimes, not all the time, with low-dose naltrexone. The next one underneath the sensory issues to your, you know, going clockwise is eye contact, and, you know, I don't see a whole great improvement necessarily in eye contact when I give low dose naltrexone, but I definitely see a healthier child who is more aware of their environment, and therefore eye contact may be noted to be more improved. Under that is sleep disturbances. Because, as we'll talk about later, the best time to give it is after the children fall asleep, I'm often asked if it's going to disturb their sleep. And I can say that it's really only about 1 or 2% of patients who get it where it actually disturbs their sleep. And in fact, more than 50% of the patients, the parents claim that the child slept better than ever. Underneath that is the low tone. Low tone is a core tone problem that our children have. Again, this is less likely to be addressed by naltrexone, but as we are able to improve the child's energy production, we're able to reverse what people, signs and symptoms that people call autism. Gastrointestinal problems are definitely addressed by low-dose naltrexone, and that's because the one that's just to the left of that as you're going clockwise is immune regulation, which many of our children, the parents give the low-dose naltrexone protocol for years because they'll just say that it was the last time that the kid ever got really sick. And many of our children have been sick multiple times and received multiple doses of antibiotics. And just the fact that the child no longer requires that and those setbacks, I keep the LDN on board. So as opposed to a lecture I might have given 2 years ago where I was trying to find out, you know, how many responded, I practically give every child a chance at low-dose naltrexone now. And I'll talk about how I do that. And then the last box that we didn't talk about is those behavioral issues. And again, many of those behavioral issues will get addressed, okay, by the use of low-dose naltrexone. I don't know if it's because the child has better sleep or their immune system is better, but they don't, and their focus is definitely better. And I often tell my parent that they can expect the oppositional behavior to diminish a lot. We give it at nighttime, and in the morning they wake up in a better mood. The two boxes that are not attached on this slide are children who have seizures and children who have cognitive defects. And they're not attached because I'm not sure how they relate. Not that they don't relate, I'm just not sure of the exact relationship. And this will be the full slide now, where we see three cogs in this wheel. Why do we see more autism now, and we have individual susceptibility. When there was a plague in England in the Middle Ages, everyone didn't die. Okay, why didn't everyone die? Why doesn't everybody have autism? Because certain people are susceptible and certain people aren't. And that's, I don't know why it needs to be any more complicated than that. And we'll talk about what confers individual susceptibility in a little while. A toxic environment. So if we don't think that the, at least in the U.S., that the 85,000 chemicals in the air, food, and water are adding to the burden for those susceptible individuals of, and the challenge of normal development, then we're thinking that all chemicals are good for all people all the time, and that would be impossible. And just as impossible would be finding out which chemicals in an 85,000 chemical soup, in an 85,000 ingredient chemical soup, figuring out exactly which chemical or which combinations is going to take a really complicated computer algorithm. But what we see is the phenotypic expression. Okay, so what that slide represents is that combination leads to variations in what they show, but again, the core symptoms of social isolation, speech delay, and movement issues, repetitive movements, restricted interests, that those core issues are what we call autism. And there's no mistaking it. I didn't get it wrong 30 years ago when I was seeing cocaine babies. There's no mistaking how these children look. And again, the way this slide was originally put, there's each one of these talks is a click. So I don't know if the user is looking at the whole slide or just each click. But this is the types, an example of the types of autism that I see. At least 15% of our patients have a genetic type. And again, the reason that I'm going over this is the listener, the user can understand better where naltrexone, especially the low-dose naltrexone protocol, fits in this. It's not exactly matter which type of autism I'm seeing. There are many reasons that the low dose naltrexone protocol is working, so that even in a genetic variation, that genetic variation may be affecting the gastrointestinal system or the immunologic system. So in that sense, you are overcoming a genetic weakness. The gastrointestinal problems that we see are those who are most commonly affected. Absolutely greater than 60% of our children have a significant history of either reflux as a child, poor breastfeeding. I can't emphasize enough to anyone who's out there that if a child is not breastfeeding well, it's not the mother's fault. It's weakness on the part, in today's world. In most times, it's not a milk allergy. It's not what she's doing. In today's world, it's that the child doesn't have an adequate suck. And those children who start out with an inadequate suck often have gastroesophageal reflux, go on to have multiple infections, and again, to the extent that low-dose naltrexone can help their immune system, that can be ameliorated. The immunologic is included to that, so we have a question about one of the things that a lot of people ask is, do I believe that vaccinations cause autism? And the answer is that you'd have to say that all vaccinations are good for all children all the time in order to justify that there is no risk. And then once you agree to that issue, then you'd have to say which vaccinations, at what age, given over what period of time, in what dose, to what children. And that really is what's coming out right now. Only about 5% of my patients, and we've seen that the patients now give a good proximate history that it was related in their world to a vaccination. They have a picture of the child before, they have a picture of the child the next day, he's crying his head off, he's got red face, high fever, and the next day after that, he doesn't talk. And I know that sounds crazy to what the scientific world understands. But when you see case after case like that, and 5% of my cases is a significant number, you start to believe the parent. Mitochondrial syndromes will definitely have metabolic disturbances that are sometimes addressed in this way. Birth complications are a type of autism that really aren't that amenable to too much help when you're looking at the autistic side of things. Though the new one for us is the premature babies. I took care of premature babies for many years, and they did not develop autism. And all of a sudden, in this century, there's definitely an increased risk. The metabolic and nutritional deficiencies, obviously, unless you fix those first, you're not going to, you address them, which means you have to do tests for them, which I find that in many countries, doctors don't even do minimal testing like a blood count, liver and kidney function, vitamin D, vitamin A. How do they know if it's thyroid that's affecting a child who has low tone? There's so many easy tests to do in every country that could help determine the kind of autism. But again, you'd have to fix those issues before you could really see a therapy like low-dose naltrexone do its job. I actually have to see a difference in the boy versus the girls. The boys are 75% more aggressive, and the girls are 75% less aggressive. I'm less likely, for example, to use naltrexone in the girls unless they are more aggressive, because I'm trying to decrease their aggression, or if they have an immune problem. And then there's the early versus late kind. So there's children who from the earliest time have reflux at 6 months old. They're not quite sitting. Instead of crawling at 9 months old, they're doing an army crawl. And then by 2 years old, they're still not speaking, versus the child who's been developing normally at 12 months old, babbled, at 18 months old was saying a few words, and then all of a sudden stopped speaking. So in order to decide how we're going to go about treating any patient, I know that every doctor out there usually does a medical workup to determine what exactly the precise diagnosis is. And so a detailed history and physical needs to be done, including a review of systems, but mostly a review of the family history, knowing that there were two uncles who had Asperger's, and there was a grandfather who had schizophrenia, and the mother and her mother both had thyroid conditions, is going to increase your awareness and suspicion of an autoimmune or a central nervous system condition that this child could have somehow inherited. The specialized treatment starts with audiology. We actually had a patient from Canada who hadn't had an audiology test and came to our clinic with the diagnosis of autism because he wasn't responding to his name, and it was actually his hearing. And so, of course, that should be checked. An MRI is questionable at this time, whether or not the anesthesia is worth, the risk of anesthesia is worth what you're going to learn from an MRI. I'd say that that, as part of a medical workup at this time, is controversial. And the EEG, electroencephalogram, especially in the face of a possible seizure, is important. Again, through using low-dose naltrexone and being able to reduce the repetitive behaviors and restricted interests, the patient's physical exam may warrant less use of a treatment, of a medical evaluation like an EEG. As I said before, the chromosomes are a type of autism, is chromosomal copy number variation, and that can represent up to 15% of cases, and it's 2017 now, and it's sort of amazing to me that every patient who's suspected to have this wouldn't have that checked. A blood count is, of course, a basic thing if we want to know whether the child is malnourished or anemic, or whether we can help the child with just simple things like iron and better nutrition. And again, the ability for naltrexone treatment to work is only going to be dependent about on whether or not you've gotten the underlying conditions that the child is exposed to. So a thyroid screen is definitely indicated, and other appropriate information based on whether a thorough exam and history was taken. In this slide, I've summarized what the medical workup will find for most of our patients who have signs and symptoms that are called autism spectrum disorder. And so the most common, as I said earlier, the most common type of autism that we see are children who have some kind of GI health problem, either diarrhea or constipation, gastroesophageal reflux, a history of poor suck, a history of poor feeding, a history of very, very picky eaters, children who won't chew, and everything has to be pureed. It's not going to be easy to train a child who doesn't have good GI health. So just by helping that, we can help the family. Food allergy, I'm looking for IgG food allergies, that it's an important finding for us for what foods those patients might avoid so that they don't use up their intracellular reduced glutathione levels and therefore have poor energy production. So there's often misunderstanding about why we're asking parents not to use those foods that would be highly allergenic on an IgG side, not because it directly causes the behavior, but because the body uses up a lot of energy ridding itself of the inflammation or the toxins from diet. Vitamin D levels have already been shown in many, many studies, and most recently, 6 months ago, that just treating with vitamin D helps ameliorate signs and symptoms of autism. And it's just a complete mystery to me how a physician can make a diagnosis in today's world of autism and not check vitamin D levels. Again, our ability to be successful with any other compounds, including naltrexone, is going to be hindered if the child has underlying vitamin deficiencies. The metabolic profile depends a lot on the resources that are available and the resources that the parents can muster, the doctor and the parents can muster, to get to more granular levels about why the child is not developing appropriately. Again, a little less tied to the naltrexone itself, but we do look at lipid panels, and actually low lipids are more important in autism than high lipids, which are cardiovascular disease, obviously. So the conventional treatments are strong medications like Abilify or Risperidone. A less strong medication that is a blood pressure medication is Intuniv. It's also called 10X or Guanfacine. But what we need to understand about these anxiety medications is that they're just Band-Aids, and they only represent decreasing apparent anxiety. That if a five-year-old is having problems in a situation with other five-year-olds where he or she doesn't have the skill set of those other children, then they're going to be appropriately anxious. And maybe the right thing to do is to give that child some low-dose naltrexone, which can calm them down and let them observe the other children without getting so anxious and therefore not needing very strong anxiety medications. I'm often asked when I start naltrexone, you know, is this a medication? Are they going to get addicted to it? You know, is it bad? How long are they going to have to take it? And yet, when a physician, a neurologist or a psychiatrist or some pediatricians who use stimulant medication, when they order that on children, the parent rarely asks those questions. And yes, they are addicted. And yes, they are going to take it for a long period of time. And yes, it is going to cause significant side effects. So when we look at the risk from a protocol like this versus the strong drugs, I don't see how they're even equivalent. The methamphetamines are still used in children as young as 5 and 6 years old to, quote, slow them down. Again, I find that low-dose naltrexone, I find that low-dose naltrexone can do a much better job, much safer job and is much more likely to be successful than giving these strong stimulant medications. Likewise, the SSRIs such as Zoloft or Prozac, we have 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds on Prozac, and we have to question why that child that young should be taking a drug with so many potential side effects. I know that there's no study. If today's world, a child might live to the age of 100. So there's no study to say that. And there's a patient who's lived for 9.5 years on Prozac. You know, there's nothing like that. And there really is a lot of experimenting on children that's going on right now with the psychiatrists and the neurologists using these medications that were not meant for young children. And again, it's a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned to give a trial of naltrexone to those children. And I've even seen children on anti-seizure medications as strong as trileptal Depakote, just to calm down their behaviors, which could have been much more appropriately treated. This slide summarizes the available treatments. One of the things that I like to point out to all my colleagues who think that a parent who goes for a stem cell transplant or hyperbaric chambers or would put worms in the child's stomach to help their immune system, that they're not crazy, okay? They're not stupid. They're desperate. That we do not have good answers for autism today. We don't understand why. We don't understand how. We don't understand about prevention. We don't understand about treatment. So the parent who is getting a whole lot of negative information from the doctors and maybe some positive information from Dr. Google and the like is going to give these things a try. They're not going to just give up on their child. And that, again, has been why for me, and naltrexone has been such a godsend, because they can see just by using this basically innocuous therapy, that there is hope for their child. And this slide goes over what I said before, which is that you always have to do traditional treatment as well. Nothing that we're talking about today is going to work unless you teach the child how to talk correctly, how to act correctly, how to be with other children, physical therapy and occupational therapy. A lot of them are very sensory. Everything is very, touch is very difficult for them. And so naltrexone can be very helpful in those sensory children. The treatment depends on the underlying condition. This slide it shows treatment, behavioral difficulties, and speech apraxia. And the reason that I showed this slide is because it's behavioral difficulties and speech apraxia that are the most difficult to address, especially with conventional therapies. And you can see that the use of low-dose naltrexone basically helps me cone down to the communication disorders that the children have rather than spending a lot of time on the repetitive behaviors or the negative behaviors that they may exhibit. The next several slides is one of the first studies that came out that described the endorphin response giving naltrexone. It describes a beta endorphin dysregulation in autistic children, and the implication therefore would be that if you had a therapy that could address that, that you might be able to address some of these behaviors. That was the original slide. Should have been 1988. And that, again, it shows that there's disruption, dysregulation of endogenous opiates in the children anyway. And that may be the reason why we're seeing some of the behaviors, some of the repetitive behaviors, some of the self-injurious behaviors. So the use of naltrexone would be indicated just for that reason alone. This is that 1988 study that I talked about. where they looked at children and gave different doses. The important thing about this slide for me is when I'm trying to convince my parents that 3 milligrams of naltrexone is okay. The reason I show this slide is because safety was proven even at a 100-milligram dose. And that's an important thing when you're about to give a strange medication to a person, to a parent's 3-year-old or 4-year-old, and they can at least know that you really mean it, that the doses that were given previously 30 years ago were proven safe, that were much higher. This is a review that was done in 1991. And this review summarizes results from a series of open and double-blind trials that have yielded positive therapeutic effects with low doses of naltrexone, including reductions in autistic stereotypes, aggressiveness, and self-injurious behaviors, and the production of heightened pro-social emotional attitudes that are accompanied by increased smiling, eye contact, attention, and attempts to communicate. How we can see a child 25 years later who has obvious signs and symptoms that are included in this slide and not give them a chance at low-dose naltrexone seems to be a shortcoming of modern medicine. This was the conclusion of this slide, of that study. The positive behavioral change seems to be enhanced by social support and how such features of therapeutic situations can be maximized to optimize clinical benefits. And so, again, you have to have the traditional therapies plus these therapies. We are not saying, no one is saying that low-dose naltrexone is going to cure autism. It is a valuable treatment modality, and it's been proven to be that. So in our colleagues who may say, well, there's no randomized controlled prospective double-blind studies, or that this is not evidence-based medicine, are going to have to argue with 30 years of studies where it is evidence-based. The biggest hole in our evidence is in the use of the low-dose naltrexone protocol that was outlined by Dr. McCandless in 2006, and that will take probably some time. Again, I supply slides like this to any of the listeners so that if you come across traditional physicians, traditional professionals who are questioning whether or not this is evidence-based medicine, they would have to argue, my position is, they would have to argue with the authors of studies such as this and not try to argue with someone like me who's just trying to clinically figure out what these studies mean in order to treat patients. This is, we're going to go through a number quickly here. I've supplied this to the user so that you would be able to show those who are skeptical that this is evidence-based medicine. This is another placebo-controlled study, placebo-controlled acute dosage naltrexone study in young autistic children. Again, this is a study that summarizes for those who are skeptical about, well, you know, the opioid system being involved and how low-dose naltrexone affects the opioid system for those who want more an in-depth discussion of that. I supplied this slide. Another double-blind study. Again, these are generally, these few studies that I'm showing now are generally higher dose naltrexone, but it does help in making your point to parents that it's okay to use low dose naltrexone. Another study that can be used by the listener. Again, what we're going to be getting to, this was a study at the beginning of this century from 1999, And you can see that what I've covered in these slides is repetitive behaviors, self-injurious behaviors, communication problems. These are core weaknesses in autism, and we're looking at slides that claim that naltrexone, you know, was a valuable treatment. I like to look at this slide because this is not Dr. McCandless' work in 2006. This is Dr. Shar's work, and again, this is on the higher dose naltrexone, but it does show efficacy and safety. This slide is, I provided this so that the user could go straight to Dr. McCandless' paper from 2006, where she writes that she completed a preliminary 8-week informal study of 15 patients who were given it, the naltrexone, after they fell asleep when supposedly endorphin levels rise. It's a great deal for us pediatricians because it's something that the parents can give, and the child is already asleep. They don't have to have a fight about how to give it. They don't have to have a fight that the child doesn't like the taste. I think it was brilliant that Dr. McCandless made it available for us in this way. I practically use it even on patients who might rather take pills, because I would rather a 7-year-old fell asleep already and then was given the naltrexone than giving it to him right before he goes to bed. And in that study that Dr. McCandless reported, about almost half the, greater than half the children had positive results. And that's what I reported the last time that I talked about this to the LDN Trust, that we had much greater than 50% of the parents were satisfied that there were improvements in their child with this low-dose naltrexone protocol. And more importantly for many of the parents is the lack of side effects. It is rarely not utilized by my patients. Just the word low-dose naltrexone, though, the practitioner needs to overcome that whole idea so that the parent understands the value of this FDA-approved medication. At the Child Development Center of America, I have changed my talk on this. One of the big changes that I make is that I'm not testing it on the children anymore. It's part of my general treatment protocol. I use it after I have gut health, and either before or after I need to address speech apraxia. And the decision about using naltrexone protocol is based on whether or not the child is extremely sensory or extremely self-injurious or has a lot of what we call STIMS, self-stimulatory behavior, repetitive behaviors, repetitive ideation. So if a child is really affected by what I consider mostly to be a gastrointestinal problem, the aggression, the children who are aggressive or not paying attention, I address gut first. And then the next thing I address is actually using naltrexone as the next part of my protocol, so that I can prepare them for protocols, for two proven protocols for speech and language acquisition. And those two protocols are methyl B12 by subcutaneous injection and folinic acid by oral in oral form in high doses, over 15 milligrams. Both those therapies that improve speech need to be, the side effect of both of those therapies is a lot of agitation, a lot of stimming, a lot of aggression. So now what I've done is, depending on how aggressive the child is, I will start a naltrexone before I even give them one of those two proven therapies. My success with low-dose naltrexone, but depends on whether I've made an accurate diagnosis in the patient. If the patient has an underlying metabolic disease or a serious chromosomal problem, we're going to have to look at other treatments to address the side effects that the treatments are doing to those more affected children. You always have to address gut and metabolic issues first. And as I said, we have to see if they're having repeated ear infections or urinary tract infections, because those comorbidities will set the children back. And again, naltrexone, low-dose naltrexone, has been very successful in my practice in preventing children from having recurrent infections. The form that it can be given in is a liquid or pill or a cream. The taste of it is very bitter, so a pill form if they'll take it. And as I said earlier, the cream is great. Parents always ask, when am I going to see a difference? Some parents have seen a difference in as few as a few days. Some parents, if you're going to see a definite improvement, we'll see an improvement in the first few weeks. However, as I said, since it decreases the number of repeated infections, I'll ask parents to continue it for months and months at a time and see if the number of recurrent infections don't go down. So if a mom says, well, my child normally gets sick 3 or 4 times a year, and then in the next year we use a naltrexone protocol, and she finds that, oh, that's right, he only got sick one time this year. It takes the time of use before you're going to understand how valuable an intervention this can be. About 5% of my patients discontinue because the child gets stimmy, the child gets aggressive, the child gets more active, and it won't go away after giving just a half dose over a week or two. So most parents are not going to try too many therapies for more than 2 or 3 weeks when their child is too stimmy from it. It's just impossible to live with the kids, and so you have to find another way around it. Now, what I may do is I may get the gut under better control first and then go back in some of those children and give them naltrexone again. And we're going to get to the conclusions that you can make from what I'm talking about from my use of low-dose naltrexone for the past several years. The first point is that autism is a complex, multi-system condition. It's a set of conditions. There isn't one autism, and it leads to behavioral and developmental signs and symptoms that we call autism. But since there's different causes and different effects on different children, it's very difficult to pin down. The second is we have to agree that it's of epidemic proportions, and it is. And the third is that there are many treatable conditions, and the combination of therapies and medical intervention at the earliest stage provides the best chances for recovery. Latest research is that autism involves brain, gut, and inflammation issues. At least there's an understanding in modern times that it's a whole body issue, as at first described by Martha Herbert in her seminal book called The Autism Revolution. There are safe medications that are useful, but they are very, very few and far between. That since I started doing this over 10 years ago, and the doctors that have been doing this for over 20 years have seen very few therapeutic breakthroughs, surprisingly few. Okay, and that we had to learn about genetics and susceptibility, and that we needed to combine what's going on in the environment so that it is very complicated, and that's where we are with the state of knowledge for a lot of autism right now. Given all those variables, low-dose naltrexone is certainly worth a try in any patient who exhibits signs and symptoms. And the continued problem is that we don't have an actual randomized, controlled, prospective, double-blind study on using low-dose naltrexone in children. And, you know, from where I sit, that seems fine, but I'm a clinician and I'm not here to study my patients, I'm here to treat them. This represents the chapter in my the low-dose naltrexone book, my chapter in that book, which was kindly edited, and all the work was done, and all I did was try to get stuff in on time with Linda Elsgood, and thank her for all her work that let me do this. And it's been a great collaboration on my part. When we first met, I didn't know that naltrexone was given to adults, and apparently most adults that take it don't know that it's given to children. And so I want to thank everyone who's listened to this. And if I have some inaccuracies, please write to me and I'll try to understand them and get back to you on any of those. And this is just the beginning of a treatment protocol that I think is going to be real valuable for all our patients who have developmental delay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this presentation. All past conference presentations can be found on our website, www.ldnresearchtrust.org.